Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the top-tier brewing stand. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters, back for another episode of Brew Strong.
Hello, neighbor.
Creepy.
That's my co-host, John the Rock Palmer. I'm also here with my good friend, Mike Tasty McDowell.
Good morning.
Also, hey, Tasty.
Hey, how you doing, John?
Co-host on Kane, You Brew It. And we're going to be talking about milling today, and Tasty just went through a big episode of not being able to brew because his brew shop changed their mill gap, and he ended up having to get his own mill and all that. So he's got some real world pain here.
I'm in transition.
I can see it in his face. I can see it in his face. You know, suffering big time. Well, we're not suffering, and you know why?
Why?
There you go. See, it took you a while to come up with the why. because we have a fine sponsor in Blickman Engineering. They're taking care of us. Not only are they paying cash money, so you guys can listen to the show for free, but Blickman's been sending me some goodies in the mail.
Oh, did you get an auto sparger, did you?
Yes.
Very slick little item, I must say.
Yeah, very cool. I haven't had a chance to fire it up yet because... I'm working on that.
Because you don't brew.
Yeah, that's true. I don't brew anymore. I talk about brewing, and I write about brewing, and I drink.
That's all you have time for.
And that's pretty much it, yeah. Now, as soon as I get this yeast book done, I'm gonna fire up a batch for Can You Brew It, and I'm going to use that auto sparge on that. And John Blickman he's hinted at a number of other products that they're going to be bringing to market here pretty soon. Some innovative new stuff that he said he'd send me a sample once those were ready too. So I'm loving this new sponsor. I tell you,
this
is some good stuff, Blickman. And,
neat. It's neat seeing great ideas become reality. I mean, you think as you're brewing, it'd be nice if I had something that would do this, and then lo and behold, this product appears. Autosparger, it's a nifty device. It's made out of brass and stainless. It's got a stainless float valve on it that you set in the mash tun.
Right.
And as that float ball rises, it opens the valve and adds more sparge water to the mash. It's just an easy way to fly sparge.
Yeah, there's no power required or anything. It's all mechanical action, so that's pretty cool.
I'm looking forward to using it.
And John Blickman strikes me as the kind of guy, like, if you had an idea that you wanted to see or some sort of pain point in your brewing process and you wanted him to invent something, send him an email at blickmanengineering.com. And, you never know. Probably a year later, you'll see it. He'll come up with a product to solve that problem. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. All right, so Justin, we're talking about milling today. We know that for a fact, but the question is, who asked for it, and what exactly did they want to know?
Here you go.
Hi, this is Larry from Northern Indiana. My question is, should I mill my grain or buy it milled? I usually buy two or three kits milled at a time to save on shipping and then store them in my beer fridge. Is it worth buying my own mill? If I buy a mill, how do I use it? Should I buy a fixed or an adjustable mill? And why would I ever need to adjust it? Thanks.
Those are all excellent questions, Larry. It's not as simple as, do I crush or not crush my grain? There's a lot of other little things that go into owning your own mill, And even whether you should or not, and again, you know, Tasty didn't own his own mill. He's brewing a brilliant beer for many years,
yeah.
And then a change kind of forced him into getting one. Before we really get into the topic, let's define milling. John, you want to give us a definition of what milling is?
Okay, well, what you're doing is you're taking the barley kernel and crushing it between two rollers, typically, sometimes four rollers. But what you're trying to do is smash the contents of the kernel, which is the what we call the endosperm. It's a protein carbohydrate matrix that contains the starches that we want to convert to sugars and then extract. And by crushing as opposed to grinding the kernel, we are leaving the husk intact. This accomplishes two things. It gives us an insoluble, medium or the flake that helps keep the grain bed loose, keeps the wort able to flow through the grain bed better by keeping that husk intact. And by not grinding the husk, you reduce the surface area and reduce tannin extraction from the husk, during laudering. So when we crush, what we're trying to do is make these starches more accessible to the enzymes. And the degree of crush has a direct effect on how long you need to mash to achieve conversion.
So, and efficiency and
all those things.
A lot of things. So, yeah. The ideal crush would be everything inside the husk becomes a powder, and the husk is completely 100% intact and doesn't fall apart. That would be ideal, right?
And then it would take about 5 weeks for that to lauder. Yeah.
Well, you got all the husks in there. That's got to help.
Yeah.
But isn't that an overbalance of powder, though, when you...
Yeah, the finer you grind it, the harder it is for liquid to flow around it because the particles fit together tighter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got the husk in there, but the permeability of the grain bed decreases with an increase in the crush.
You get kind of a cementing effect in between the husks.
Right.
That powder would form a cement in between each husk, kind of binding the whole thing together into a giant mat.
Yeah. You end up with oatmeal and, porridge instead of a lauderable grain bed. So different, the ideal crush varies. It depends on, how you're mashing and how you're laudering that beer to what the ideal crush really is.
Mm-hmm.
And so... We'll talk about that more, I think, as the talk goes on.
Okay. All right. I was kind of talking about it now, but if you want to wait,
we can do that.
That's fine.
Okay.
I'm plenty comfortable with just waiting for you to get to it when you feel like it. But
you wanted to bask in my knowledge. I didn't realize. Okay.
I'm basking here. Yes, I'm basking. so while we're on the crush. The crush I've always looked for is, the husk is intact as much as possible, and the innards of the grain is broken up into multiple pieces.
How many would you say? What would you say? What are you thinking? 12?
Yeah.
12? I heard. Okay.
Yeah, like 6 to 12, I guess.
I had one brewer, Adam Lamoureux, told me he breaks his into two pieces, and half of it's still in the husk, he says.
Sure.
That's his ideal crush.
Yeah.
Then other guys, like, they just pulverize it to no end.
Right. See,
so it's all over the board.
I wouldn't pulverize it. I'd go more with the larger size. And, if you get to... there's a book from the MBAA, their Practical Handbook series. And in Volume 1, they have one on milling, and it's got this table on malt grinds. And essentially, they they have a technique of measuring the grind or the crush. And
sieve analysis, yeah.
And they run it through this mesh and on a shaker table, and you see how much goes through at a various sizes, and then you weigh that amount, and it gives you the percentage of how much, you know, of various sizes you have in your crush and how you're doing with your crush. And the interesting thing about this table is they break down for you the size of the sieve, and it's 1.4 millimeter, 1 millimeter, 0.6, a quarter, an eighth, and flour. And they match that up to typical usage in a British mash tun, a U.S. craft mash tun, and a European lauter tun, and when somebody's using a mash filter. So the type of brewing you're doing, the type of tun you're using, is going to affect it. So in the British one, it's larger, much more larger particle sizes.
Coarser
so,
mash.
Yeah, it's a coarser grist, 53% at the 1.4 millimeter size. And then U.S. is 31%. And a European lauter tun, 27%, and on a mash filter, 11%. So, with single infusion, they're saying that you go with a larger, a coarser crush in order to for the equipment that you're using.
Yeah, because you're in the English system, you're doing the mash and lauter in the same vessel.
Mm-hmm.
So to encourage good flow, you need the larger particle sizes.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, that lauter will take too long.
Right.
But
if you got a mash filter or a specialized lauter tun, they tend to be shallower and runoff is easier, right? You can go with a much finer grist.
Right. And you get better extraction in a shorter period of time with a finer crush. And so by going to... But the lautering takes longer, comparatively. So what they do there is they pump it from the mash tun, short time, pump it to a lauter tun. Then they can take more time to lauter that grist and use mash rakes and so on to help keep the bed real fluid and flowing. And then they can start another batch in the mash tun while they're lautering.
Well, you know what? I bet who could tell us a lot about this? Bob Hansen from Breese Malting.
Hey guys.
Very knowledgeable guy.
Hey Bob, how you doing? Thanks for joining us.
Is the noise I'm banging, cleaning my dishwasher up making too much noise here?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
So,
how about that? Did you hear that?
Yeah, we heard that.
Yeah, we heard that. Maybe drop the phone a couple of times.
Great, okay.
So, Bob, what is the type of crush you're looking for in a professional brewery setting?
Well, you guys have touched upon it. There's a couple things when it comes to the crush. There's some quality related aspects. Those tend to actually be much smaller than anybody would think, unless you're making American Pilsner. But then beyond that, it's really more about what's going to give you good extraction efficiency and good solid liquid separation efficiency in your brew house. So as you guys have already alluded to, it's really dependent on your system. And I would say, the best crush is the one that works good for what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different from a home brewer because, they have different economic considerations and equipment where, for a large brewer, they're very concerned about getting the maximum amount of extract out because, 1% brew house efficiency for them is millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So they put in specialized mills and really track the things, as you mentioned. There's a similar talk or a similar good piece of information that's available if you go on our website. And you under Malting 101 in technical presentations, there's a talk on practical milling for the craft brewer.
Hmm.
Craft brewers are, kind of in between home brewers and large brewers. And, they read the same literature and have the same ideas about what they want in a crush, and they have the same worries. But, again, they have different economic considerations and time considerations. So that talk kind of discusses how a good crush is measured, how to optimize it, what its value to you economically is, and a few things about a different ways of milling. So, kind of as you mentioned, depends on your system. If you're using a mash filter, as John mentioned, you'll They have a very thin layer that's used for solid liquid separation in the filter. It's, you know, only like an inch. And you can push in a mass filter. You can push with pressure. So you can really, it makes it very easy to louder. So you typically hammer mill it to a flour. You grind everything up, very small particle size. And you can get extract efficiencies of, you know, over 100% using a mash filter. So that's great for efficiency. It's hard to do on a small basis, you know, for homebrewer. So then, you know, as you mentioned, you've got a normal large production brewery trying to do 12 brews a day through a five-vessel system with a mash, separate mash and a lauer tun. And they'll try to get a fairly fine grind, but not too fine, because that extract efficiency, you know, they're trying to get lauer tun cycle times of 90 minutes, and they'll gain they can gain maybe an extra percent or two of extract by milling finer, but it'll slow that bottleneck time down in the lauer tun, and typically a lauer tun is the bottleneck in the brew house. So they'll go for a finer grind. And then John alluded to the English system, where you know, it's combination mash lauer tun. There, because you're doing it in both vessels, you're still trying to get as many brews through a day, but you're using a kind of the one vessel, so that getting a good separation is really critical, because of the length of time in there. Plus, they tend to run, just, you know, based on tradition and design, with deeper grain beds, and they tend to try to keep the mash floating a little bit more throughout the lautering process, so a very gentle process. So they go for coarser grains. In terms of, you know, a home brewer, you know, I know some guys like to get, you know, very high brew house efficiencies in their home brew, and because they enjoy calculating it and things like that. But, you know, I don't think you're going to save a lot of money by, you know, getting a mill that can perfectly tune your crush, just because the malt isn't that expensive, and you're going to spend a bunch of time doing it. That talk, that little presentation on our website, kind of alludes to that. It says, well, you know, you could spend, you could spend 30 minutes a day extra loudering and get a better extract efficiency. But when you figure out what that's worth, you only save in a 10 barrel system, you might save $5, and you're going to spend $5 being there for the extra half an hour. So, you know, you're not going to save money by doing it. Quality aspect, I would say, you know, unless you're really doing a bad job and grinding it too much, I wouldn't say it would, even too fine of a grind is really going to affect your quality, because realize that these people like Coors that are making American Pilsner on a mash filter, they're grinding them all to a flour. Now, if you've got a very fine grind and that extends your lautering time, so now it's sitting around for a long time, you've got longer time to extract the tannins, and you're trying to add hot water to it, then you might be extracting tannins. But for the normal beer that a home brewer is making, not to say that you know, there isn't quality considerations. If a home brewer is trying to make an American Pilsner or a Kolsch or something that's super light, but in terms of, you know, tannin extraction, it's I would say it's minor for most craft styles of beer. I guess I shouldn't say homebrewed styles of beer, because homebrewers, you know, produce everything. But for most craft beer, you know, tannin extraction and the grind isn't a concern. They probably have bigger concerns with having a sparge temperature that's water that's the right temperature, because, you know.
And pH?
And pH, yeah. Those would probably be bigger considerations. So,
you
know, kind of
interesting.
Kind of the right grind depends on you know, your setup. I would, as a homebrewer myself, I've learned through years of everything taking longer than I wanted it to, that I would rather go with a coarser grind and, you know, better lautering times and give up a little bit on extraction than I would for, you know, a fully optimized grind to get maximum extraction.
Well, Bob, this is Tasty. We talk about grind as if it doesn't really affect the body and the flavor of the beer. It's more of a tuning of it to your system, but it does affect the body and the flavor, doesn't it? I mean, I'm, as a home brewer, I'm noticing that as my efficiency jumped to 84% from 74%, I'm losing a lot of the depth and the character in my beer.
Yeah, I don't know from just a simple grind point of view, what actually would cause that.
So it's also then probably related to pH, water temperatures, contact time. So if you're taking a long time in the mash and you have a finer crush, that might have an effect?
Yeah, it could be that too, and it depends on maybe the reason why your extract efficiency is going up. If you're doing a better job of managing, say, your water balance and some of the other things in there, you know, realize that when you're sparging, you're running water across the grain, and there's, you know, some papers out there in the MBA and in the Briggs book that show the last worts that you collect on a dry basis or, you know, on a solids basis contain much more of the things you don't necessarily want. So your first runnings from a mash are you know, really good. But when you're down below 4 Plato, you start to differentially extract more, and you're running in a water across your grain to increase your extracts. You start to differentially extract more tannins, more coloring compounds, things that can cause oxidative problems. So the last bit of extract is typically the lowest value and the lowest quality by far. I mean, some of these things go up by, on a solids basis, they go up like a factor of 10, you know, in the last worts. The main reason that big brewers try to get that extract efficiency is they really have to because, one, the raw ingredients cost them $1 million, but two, if they send that sugar down the drain, they got to pay for the BOD, you know, so it's very expensive. Yeah. That's one of the reasons that, you know, craft beers, you know, in my opinion, are so, you know, clean and well done, is that, you know, typically your average craft brewer stops collecting at 4 Plato, and he leaves behind the lowest quality wort, which is the stuff below there. And typically a craft brewer might, you know, have a brew house efficiency of 80% or 85% and be quite happy with that. But, you know, that wouldn't work at a big brewery. So that might explain why, you know, if you're getting an increase in your extract efficiency, why your, you know, your beers seem to be maybe not as full-bodied or clean.
Now, can you tell us what you guys do there at Breese? Is that something you can share with us?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, let me jump in for just a second here, Bob. We've had you on our show, in the past a couple times, and Jamil and I, you know you from way back. But I thought it might be a good idea to introduce you a little bit more to the listeners that may not be familiar with who you are and
who
what you do
know
for Breese.
Come on,
yeah. I know it's kind of odd to think.
Hey,
about.
I'm not a Jamil or a John, so.
Who is?
So yeah, go ahead and to Bob and tell us a little bit about yourself and about Breese Malting.
Okay, well, I've been a homebrewer for about 21 years. I started back in the dark ages of beer when really you bought it not by the type but by what size package you wanted, and that drove me to homebrewing beer because back then, you know, we anxiously awaited the specialty beers that like Liney's Bock and Huberbach that would come out, you know, once a year. So quickly, within a year or two, I started working at a brew pub in Milwaukee called Water Street Brewery, which was an extract brewery. And I worked there while I was in college, and then for about 10 years, I actually helped expand their company from one restaurant brewery to like 11 restaurants and two breweries and contract brewing operations. And then I did consulting as well with them, or I guess on my own while I was working there and after that. And then I started working at Breese about 8 or 9 years ago, and my first job was to commission their 500-barrel extract plant, which is a fully automated plant that kicks out, you know, 8 or 9 brews a day, 500 barrels. Mm. And I worked in their pilot brewery and kind of became in charge of their technical services and recently quality, so now I'm their technical manager and in charge of new product development and technical troubleshooting for breweries large and small, as well as recipe formulation for BYO magazine and a lot of other fun things that I still get to do with homebrewing magazines and the homebrewing industry, including things like this, talking on the show.
Well, and I'll say you're one of the most knowledgeable people that in the industry, and you're also one of the most homebrewer-friendly people in the industry.
Yep, that's why we always like having on the show.
Yeah, there's a lot of smarter guys than me out there, but I've seen it from 5 gallons to 5,000. So that makes me a bit. I hope it makes me a bit more practical. And one of the things that I've always struggled with is I'm kind of a technical and geeky kind of guy too. And I read all the papers and books, and I get all these ideas in my head that I must do something a certain way. Otherwise my homebrew will be terrible and I'll suffer dire consequences. And over the years, I guess I've gained the practical experience that I've learned which one of those things are really important and when. And that's what I mm-hmm. feel is one of the best things I can share to both craft brewers and homebrewers alike. And like I said, there's that presentation on that on our website, and that's kind of my attempt to deal with this issue, because there's a lot of information out there, and a lot of it's true in some respect, but it's really true depending on what type of brewery you're running, and it maybe doesn't apply to home brewers.
Well, that's why I'm curious about Breese. How do you extract, when you're making your malt extract, how do you extract the sugars from the mash?
Well, I'll start off, I'll talk a little bit about the kind of milling that we do at work.
Uh-huh.
I immediately upgraded from a Corona in our pilot mill when I started working there. And we have a two-roller valley mill with adjustable rollers mm-hmm. that I hook up to a drill.
Uh-huh.
So typically I use our pre-ground malt in the pilot brewery, unless, there's several varieties that we don't pre-grind. Or if I'm getting it from somebody else where it's not pre-ground, or if it's a new product or something, then I'll simply use a two-roller valley mill. The pre-ground malts that we manufacture for brewers and home brewers, we have a four-roller mill. It's just a dry mill, and it doesn't have any screens in it. And in the plant, which is a 500-barrel extract plant, we've got a six-roller mill, which has the typical traditional in-train screens in between. And the way a six-roller mill is working, it's kind of like you guys were talking about an ideal crush. It's the dry mill or dry milling process attempt to do exactly what you're doing. There's two individual sets of rollers that are completely separate. And the grain comes down, it goes through the first set of rollers, which are set wide, and those crack the plump kernels. So it just kind of bumps them and cracks them, and so the real fat kernels, the plumper ones, the ones that would be normally on the bigger sieve screen, mm-hmm. Those will crack, and their guts will spill out, and the small ones will go right through. And then that whole the what comes out of those two rollers goes across a series of screens and shaker screens, and it shakes them, and the grits or the insides of the endosperm and the flour go right on through. The grits go through kind of one set of screens and go down one funnel, and the flour goes through and actually passes all the way through the machine. And then on top, any of the intact husk or unground kernels pass. Then through the second set of rollers, which are set a little bit tighter, those are set to capture the thin grains. It cracks those grains. It then goes across a second series of screens, which separates out, again, the husk and the big grits from the endosperm, and the flour goes through. And then the third set of rollers takes those grits from the first and the second break, and so these are grits from the endosperm, big chunks of the endosperm, and breaks those down. So at the end of the process, you've cracked the big kernels and the small kernels, you've squeezed the guts out, you've separated the guts from the endosperm, and you've broken up the big chunks of the endosperm in a grit miller. And you end up with, say, 5% fine flour, a lot of very small grits that would look about the size of poppy seeds, and almost completely intact husk. So the husk might be in two or three pieces.
So the home brewer could do this with a hammer and some tweezers, and right. Sorting them out.
Magnifying glass.
You guys mentioned the guy who breaks his kernels in half. I'm like, guy must be. What is he, a samurai? How did he do that? That's not such a bad way to do it. But I don't know how he accomplishes it. So, but anyway, so and we have a mill like that because it's. We're going through 150,000 pounds of grain a day, and mm-hmm. We want to get the extract efficiency out
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have a big, expensive, specialized mill like that. It's not anything necessarily to do with the quality. It's really about getting the maximum extract out
mm-hmm.
In an efficient manner.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a traditional high-speed Lauterton. So
okay,
yeah.
All right. Can you hang with us through the break? All right, because I got questions for you on speed of the mill, wet milling, double milling, all that good stuff. Back okay. after this.
Brew right. Brew smart. Brew strong. This is Brew Strong. When Blickman Engineering set out to design a great brewing stand, they knew it had to be strong, adaptable, and last for a lifetime. The top-tier brewing stand is now proudly available at BlickmanEngineering.com. It grows with your brewing skills and equipment. Start with 5-gallon coolers on its heavy-gauge stainless steel shelves. Then move all the way up to 30-gallon pots on the high-output burner tiers. Speaking of burners, the custom Blickman Engineering top-tier burners are extremely powerful, efficient, and amazingly quiet. They have safety stops to center your pot, and they'll last a lifetime and won't rust. The top-tier brewing stand allows virtually infinite combinations from traditional gravity systems to two tiers to completely horizontal. Configure your stand the way you want and have the freedom to change it at any time in the future. Your brewing stand should adapt with you, not force you to learn a new process. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com today to configure your top-tier brewing stand and to find a local Blickman retailer. You'll be surprised with all the flexible features and the competitive price. Start brewing with Blickman from the top tier.
Downtown Joe's, located in the historic Oberon Building in beautiful downtown Napa, California, offers an award-winning brewpub experience from 8:30 a.m. to 1 a.m. every day. For 15 years at the corner of 2nd and Main, Downtown Joe's has been voted Best Night Spot 7 times and Best Brew Pub for the last 4 years in a row. Brewmaster Colin Kaminsky's handcrafted ales, like his Tail Wagon Amber Ale and Catherine the Great Imperial Stout, are the perfect accent to riverside dining, live music, and a relaxing outdoor patio. Don't miss the Beer of the Month, special rotating taps, and happy hour all day Mondays. Visit downtownjoes.com to make reservations, peruse their extensive calendar of events, or just read more about their fantastic beers. Come enjoy the fine beer, food, and music. Downtown Joe's, the award-winning brew pub where you'll feel at home.
Where were we?
You stole an oak barrel from the Mists of Ravenwood, and Lord Zinfandel the Avenger is in pursuit. Do you drop the barrel and run?
Hell no.
We need it for a Flanders Red.
I'm gonna cast Pediococcus Damnathus on the barrel.
Sorry, your ghosts are imprisoned in his winery forever.
Ugh, I hate it when Greg's the brewmaster.
This sucks!
What do we have here? Orville Rodenbach?
Buzz off, guy! We got a brew session going.
Is that an actual beer?
Yeah, I crafted it. I don't really use the dice anymore. I'm a 10th level beer nerd.
Are you a 10th level beer nerd? Do you get a long-lasting foam stand when you think about wheat malt? Then you're in good company at Northern Brewer. Northern Brewer has all your beer nerd needs, ingredients, equipment, and knowledge at northernbrewer.com. Plus, fast, cheap shipping, only $7.99 for the contiguous USA. And check out Northern Brewer's huge selection of dorky beer kits, including the pre-prohibition lager.
Perfect for steampunk!
And the single hop best bitter.
Now on cask and 10 forward!
Make 10th level at northernbrewer.com.
Hey, BNers, Brewcaster Jay here. Are you tired of hearing about great beer here in the Brewing Network that you can't get at your local bottle shop? Well, we do interviews from all over the world, and we want to taste those beers too. Finally, there's a place to turn for great beers from the other coast and beyond. Brewforia.com. Brewforia has an incredible selection of amazing beer, and they're adding more all the time. From breweries big and small, craft beer, imported beer, organic, and even gluten-free. You're going to love all the choices. When the brewcasters can't find an upcoming guest beer, we turn to Brewforia, and you should too. Just check the Brewing Network for the upcoming guest schedule and head to Brewforia.com for their beer. The great guys at Brewforia will even include free beer for you with qualifying orders. Free beer, BN Army. You know we like that. Visit our favorite online bottle shop today at BrewForia.com. That's Brewforia.com. Brewforia. When you can't get it, they can.
Hilo, what's it feel like?
Take awesome and multiply it by 2.
Yeah!
spraying live beer radio all over your face.
Can't get any better than this, baby.
It's the Brewing Network.
Like the Lance Armstrong of the beer world. Except for that nut thing.
This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking with Bob Hansen of Brees Malt Ingredients Co. And we're talking milling your grains. And so, Bob, you know, one of the things Tasty and I were talking about on milling, we've both heard that the speedier mill should not exceed 150 RPM. And so I've set my mill to like 135-ish, and Tasty's working on his. Is there any truth to that? Is that a bunch of nonsense? It has to do with shredding the husks.
Yeah, there is. I don't know if simple RPM is a best... best guideline. I would say shredding the husks is so somebody who probably has experience with small mills, you know, that may be their general observation. You know, like for a big brewery, I mean, it's more like if a big mills, it's more the speed or the differential speed between the two rollers that'll really cause that shredding action. And, you know, you can imagine if you're talking a 1-inch mill, RPM means one thing in terms of the actual speed. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking a 6-inch mill, you know, the art rollers are, you know, 6 or 8 inches in diameter.
And they're smooth, right? And they're smooth, right?
They're actually, it depends on which ones you're talking about. But some of them are fluted as well. But irregardless, the speed, you know, is more, I would say, at the contact points. I'm not sure it's as simple as an RPM thing, but that sounds, you know, I would say somebody whoever came up with that guideline probably has experience with a small mill, and, you know, I'm sure there is some RPM that's right. Mm-hmm. And that seems, that RPM, 150, seems really fast to me, thinking about a big mill, but for a little mill, that's probably right.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying if the two rollers are going at different speeds, then obviously you have kind of some pulling action across the grain, across the husk, and that's what tends to shatter the husk then. So
yeah,
differential
speed is a big
issue.
Yeah, you'll get a shear. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the simple, you know, two-roller mills, one of the rollers is driven and the other one is free on a set of rollers.
Mm-hmm.
So then just... you know, the friction or whatever will cause there to be a differential between them. So, you know, and on the big, you know, like you get a five-roller mill, like all three of the crushing ones are all driven. So then you actually have to set that differential.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, I think it's the end result that tells what your RPM is. Somebody probably, like I said, you've probably yourself then looked at it and said that, geez, if it gets too high, I'm shredding my grain. The magical number is probably more based on experience than some sort of RPM. Or if there was a magic number, it would more be the, you know, the differential speed in terms of at the surface, like, you know, centimeters per inch. That would be the bigger factor.
Mm-hmm. And what about wet milling? I was at Sierra Nevada, and they were wet milling their grain. And, you know, on the homebrew scale, I don't want to put any moisture in my mill because I know it's just going to rust before the next time I mill some grain.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I guess the theory behind that is the moisture makes the husks more pliable, and they tend not to break when they're milled. I assume there's some truth to that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That's somewhat of a standard in the you know big brewing industry, and there's a couple types of ways you can add water or wet mill. There's true wet milling where you're making a slurry, and that maybe isn't that's you see that, but maybe not as commonly. You also see malt conditioning where they'll basically spray some water on the malt to get the moisture up and then mill it after that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Sierra, New Belgium, you know, those guys, you look at, you know, it's funny how much both those companies invest in the best equipment. Because they're relatively speaking to the big guys, they're not that big.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got, you know, systems doing 12, 14 brews a day. And really, you'll see an efficiency improvement, or you probably get a bit of efficiency, but also a speed improvement when you go to wet milling. Because what happens is if you get that husk wet, it stays very pliable, and it doesn't break up really that much at all. So by condition milling or wet milling, you really get a nice grist. You can imagine, I just described to you this six-roller mill, which has got all these screens and parts and multiple rollers to try to accomplish the point of keeping the husk in one piece and getting the endosperm, you know, busted all out and soluble. Well, now, with wet milling, you're kind of, you know, everything gets kind of gushy, and, you know, you basically make a soft husk and some paste, and, you know, it's great for you know, getting instant extraction, you know, and very high efficiency and very good lautering.
And so does it even start the solubilization of the starch as well, or?
Yeah, it can. I mean, once that stuff gets wet, you know, those enzymes, they've got optimas, but they're, they're active over a variety of ranges, and that starch is damaged from the malting process, so once it gets wet, it can start working right away.
Hmm.
That said, you know, I've also seen some craft brewers, you know, people like, you know, Bells and things like that, try to screw around and you know, make their own little wet milling systems. I know you guys probably met John Mallett before. He's a, you know, he's an addicted tinkerer and engineer as well, and I remember he was trying to do some conditioned milling just to see what would happen, and came up with this, you know, fairly professionally made and logically thought out Rube Goldberg device for doing it. And but it, you know, the grain got wet. It turns into a, when malt gets wet, it turns into kind of a big sticky mess. And then you know, if it sticks around, like it hangs up anywhere, it starts molding. So
lactobacillus,
you know,
goes crazy.
Oh yeah, lactobacillus, and you know, whatever else is in there. Malt is a, you know, a veritable a gymnasium of good and bad stuff. Lots of, I mean, it's very high in micros, so mostly lactobacillus, like you said. But so from a home brewer point of view, yeah, I mean, you could precondition your mill by, you know, putting it in a bucket with you know, sprinkle a little bit of water over it and get it to you know, get the moisture up. I can tell you, we do some instantizing of grain. I think, you know, we make brewer's flakes. And to do that, we go through a process where we take the grain and we actually either shoot steam into a channel that's conveying it, or we just convey it through water. And it picks up a certain amount of water just, you know, in that initial, say, 30-second contact time. And then it goes into a tank. And in that tank, it tempers. So it evens out the moisture. So the outside of the grain is wet. And then if you leave it sit for a little while, say half an hour, that moisture in a sealed bucket, or in our case a tank, that moisture penetrates into the kernel, and you get, you know, you bring the moisture of the kernel up from, say, 12% to 30, and then you can easily cook it from the inside out. So that kind of adding water and tempering, you could do that on a at your home and then run it through your mill to achieve wet milling, or at least conditioned milling. Your concerns would be, you'd probably have to clean the goop out of your mill afterwards once it dried up, and, you know, you're getting water in there so it could rust. So, and I'm not sure it's, you know, going to give you that much better of a...
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it's always about the beer quality. I really don't care about efficiency. If you told me I had to use twice as much grain, I'd be like, yeah, okay. Well, whatever. Yeah.
Well, I'm right there with you. We talked about milling, what we do at Breeze, and I talked about our home brewery. You guys are out by Trumer, right?
Yeah.
In Berkeley?
Yeah.
My favorite pilsner in the world. And I don't know if you know, but they do endosperm mashing. Have you ever heard of that?
No,
well, I'm not convinced it's not just a gimmick, but they do it, and their beer is my favorite, you know, of its type, produced in the U.S. by far. So what they do is they run it through a mill, like our six-roller mill, like I was describing it to you, with screens in it. But then instead of putting the husks in with the mash, you know, and the grits, they run the husks into a separate tank. Then they mash all those grits, you know, basically the endosperm, and then wait in the last 15 minutes. They re-add their husk to their mash, make sure that any starch that's in it is converted, and then they begin their transfer to lauter. So, you know,
So it's to minimize contact time with the husk?
Minimize contact time with the husk.
Huh?
So that's kind of the super extreme, like, you know, we're going to remove the husk and do this. And, you know, is it the extra thing that takes their beer over the top? Yeah, I don't know. And, you know, it's kind of like decoction brewing, you know.
Right.
Lots of people don't do it, and they make beers that win as many medals as the guys that do. So, you know, and it's an interesting twist on it. So, and we've done that in our pilot brewery to try to make Trumer pills.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and with what success?
Well, yeah, it was really good.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know. It wasn't still quite exactly their beer. I mean, we duplicated their water and did all the things you do, right?
Uh-huh.
It turned out very well. The thing, we never did it the other way to truly prove if there was a, you know, and then ran it by a taste panel. But we felt good about doing it, and it was kind of fun. So
you had a bunch of beer to drink. You know.
Exactly. And we had to get some Trumer side by side.
Twice as much beer then.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, now what about double milling? I tried this once where you run the grain through. And, you know, because of the mill, and then you run it through again. I guess the idea is to, break up the endosperm even more than without damaging the husk, I guess. But, you know, the one time through the mill is just fine. The second time through the mill, it's all so fluffy that it won't go through the mill. At least that was my problem.
Yeah, it might not flow to it. You might have to shake it through because you get the husk in there. I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of what you're describing is like a six-roller mill, you know, essentially. Mm-hmm. The only reason I would ever see the double mill is because when you get, you know, if you want a killer of extract, what really kills extract is when you get malt that's got a wide assortment. You know, it's got some small grains and some big grains. Because then you can't, it's very difficult to mill it with a single two-roller mill, right? Because you either pulverize the plump ones and suffer long runoff times and possibly bad extraction from that, or you leave the small ones. And unground kernels in an unagitated mash are just, you know, an absolute killer of extract. So that would be the only reason I could ever see trying to double mill on a homebrewing basis, if you get the plump, or if you just wanted to try it, you know. Normally, though, you might try to separate out some of the husk before the, you know, with a screen before trying to do that second run. And what you would do is you'd set the first one really coarse just to get the plump ones, right? And then you'd set the second one, you know, a bit tighter to get the thin kernels.
Mm-hmm. I used to do that. When I had a two-roller fixed mill, I would run, you know, a couple pounds of the grist bill back through the mill to, you know, to grind it again. And you know, get a higher percentage of flour, basically, into the grist. Than I would if I just ran it all through once. But I only did it with a portion. I didn't do it with all of it. Because, you know, if you make all of the grist flour, you know, I'm gonna have a stuck mash. So it's going to take forever to lauter.
Yeah, flour in a lauter ton is the killer of, you know, is the killer of lautering time. So once you start to get above 10 or 15% flour, you're probably going to have a hard time.
Are you broadcasting from the yellow submarine there, Bob, or...?
Why is it? Is the water and stuff making noise?
He's taking a bubble bath.
I thought I heard you open a beer there, Bob.
I'm cleaning my brewery, and yeah, exactly. I'll move away from the equipment.
No, it's all right. It's all right.
Now, John, you mentioned that you did a double grind because you had a fixed mill. Is that right?
Yeah, I had a fixed two roller mill.
Gotcha.
And
so that's the only way you could adjust your grist is by couldn't adjust, so you just tried to do it twice to get a finer,
right?
Finer
grind. Just to increase the proportion of fines. I was getting, you know, I was getting good efficiency, but it seemed like I was getting, you know, not quite all the extraction I could out of the grain bill. I was coming up a little light on some of my recipes. And so I'd started running a couple pounds through again.
Oh, portion.
To get some, you know, get a little better conversion and extraction from some, you know, proportion of the grist.
Does the finer grist present the enzymes more emphatically? Is it going to get faster conversion, a more extensive conversion?
Yeah, it's just access. It's a matter of enzyme access.
Yep.
So that'd be the same way with a thicker mash versus a thinner mash. is everything's just closer together. If you release these enzymes, they're just going to be more accessible to the process then.
Yeah, too, but there's the other part about the size of the grit. That's like when a six-roller mill, when I talk about, we get these big chunks of endosperm, you know, they're great, but we still crush them into small grits. Because if you just plop that into the mash, you know, the starch on the outside first has to gelatinize and then convert, and those enzymes have to penetrate all the way into the inside of that grit. Mm-hmm. And then if, you know, there's like bigger chunks of protein in that matrix too, then when you go to louder, that stuff's got to migrate all the way back out, you know. So because, it's not like the stuff washes free. There is some diffusion that needs to go on. If the finer the grind, the faster the conversion will be, and the easier it will be to separate the extract. That's, you know, one of the reasons behind a mash filter, why those things work so good with very fine grind. You know, from a home brewer point of view, the same principles apply, but I don't know if it's going to save you a huge quantifiable amount of time. That stuff's probably more important for guys who are trying to do 14 brews a day. Not to say that there's probably a homebrewer out there that's not trying to do 14 brews a day.
Not every day, though.
I would try to do 14 brews a day.
Only 6 days a week, though.
Right.
Well, and, you know, I have an adjustable mill, and I bought an adjustable mill because, you know, different grains have different diameters. So if you're milling wheat or rye or all these things require different settings. But what I find myself doing is like, I just throw the whole thing in there. I'll just use more, you know, wheat or rye or whatever.
Yeah, more rye flavor, add more rye.
I haven't adjusted the thing in years. It's just, might as well be fixed because I'm not going to mess with it.
Well, as long as it's fixed right, you know.
Right. Beer seems to come out okay.
Consistent result. That's all we're looking for.
Somebody was asking me, you know, what's your mill gap? I'm like, I don't know.
Just the way I like it.
You know, seems like it's working, so it must be the right gap, whatever that would be.
I guess the typical is like 40 thousandths, 0.04.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't tell you mine either, Jamil. I mean, even in the pilot brew, what I do is I hook the drill up to it and put the gap in, put some malt in it. Because, I mean, I'll do everything from, you know, we do wacky stuff. But we'll do 100% sorghum and buckwheat. And, and I run it through half a pound and take a look at it. And, you know,
right.
If I was really curious, I'd, you know, if I didn't have the experience, I might run it through a sieve and try to stick it to a number. But, you know, I just kind of look at it. And then if I, that's why the RPM question. I can tell you that on the drill that I use at work, it's about squeezing about halfway.
All right.
I squeeze
about halfway.
Really noted.
If I squeeze it the whole way, the thing screams and it just pulverizes everything and shreds it apart. And if, you know,
squeeze
if I go too
half.
Slow, just, I'm there forever. So, yeah.
Halfway.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. Well, and, that's essentially how I set my gap as well. I tried one setting, ran some through, and the husks looked all broken up. So I moved it one notch looser.
Right.
And I ran some through, and it looked pretty good. And there it sits to this day. You know, I don't know how many years later.
One question I get time to time is, should I get a two-roller or a three-roller mill in addition to the fixed versus variable question? The third roller is kind of like your four-roller setup, Bob, I would imagine, where you've got the initial pair of rollers that do a coarse crush, and then you go through then the third roller is beneath that and forms a second pair of rollers that's tighter.
Sorry about that.
It's like Looney Tunes or something.
you get a really good audio system.
You're like a folio artist there, Bob. You're like doing some sound effects.
So with three more, you're getting a little bit finer crush going through that second pair, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean that's you heard me mention a five roller mill before. That's essentially how that works too. Is that you've got say one, you know, you've got five rollers are very similar to six rollers. They still got two sets of screens. They got two breaks, but the two breaks are achieved by using three rollers, where the first one set coarse, and the second roller kind of does double duty. Being setting the gap for the first crush and the second crush. So, yeah, that's how how those work. Because when you think about the rollers, there's really only one little, you know, one probably 20th of the radius that's actually doing something. So if you are also using the other side of that same wheel for a second crush, hey, you know, we already got a spinning wheel there. Works great. So, and then in the five roller mill, then the last two are then for the grits, and the first two. So, yeah, I guess it would depend on how good of a crush you want to get. It'll give you a good crush. I don't know how much they cost. And I got a question for you guys, because, you know, there were these Valley mills that were great. That guy doesn't make them anymore. I think, where do you get a good mill? Because I think, you know, there's Phil mills and Monster mills. Who's actually making these things anymore? That are good ones, do you know?
You know, for me, I have a Valley mill, but all the mills I've seen, they're all fine. As long as, you know, whatever the grist looks like when it comes out.
I don't know where to send somebody for one of these little mills. Because when I come in, what do you use? I'm going to get a Valley mill. Well, they're out
of business. Northernbrewer.com or morebeer.com or I don't think Blickman has one yet, but those are our sponsors, so...
Yeah,
very good.
I mean, in terms of brands, there's the Barley Crusher Malt Mill. There's the Schmidling Malt Mill. Mm-hmm. The Phil Mill. Monster and I guess Krankenstein. I think is still out there. Also, and those are the three roller mills. And I guess as guidance to listeners, you know, if you're gathering what we're saying here today. The finer crush, you know, the greater percentage of fines that you get is more applicable when, at least in a pro brewer setting, when you're using separate mash and lauter tons, where you can afford to take more time in the lauter. If you're trying to do, you know, a more English system with a single mash lauter ton in a cooler, for instance, you probably don't want a three roller mill that would do a real fine crush,
right?
Because you're gonna be stuck for hours waiting for this thing to lauter, potentially.
And like I
noted, you know, I was saying to myself I wanted a little bit more extraction from the amount of grain I was using. And I ran a couple pounds back through the two roller mill again to get a little higher percentage of fines, mix that in, and I got a little higher extraction efficiency that way. Now at the moment I'm using a three roller mill. I've got the first gap set fairly coarse. The second gap, you know, takes care of the, you know, generating some more fines, and my lautering time and my extraction is right where I want it, but it was a matter of dialing it in. It was a little matter of trial and error to get the looking at the grist to see the proportions of fines to coarse.
Hey, I think one of your listeners mentioned when do I buy a mill, and I kind of at the beginning I said, you know, I don't know if you'll save money. If you're a frequent home brewer, you know, there's a couple reasons to get one. One is because, you know, a lot of the specialty grains aren't available pre-ground. Things like our smoked malt. And I've never, I would like to hear this from you guys because you get a lot of homebrewing experience, but I've never had good luck trying to crush grain with anything other than a mill. A hammer in a bag and a rolling pin. I've never been able to Rube Goldberg anything together that would allow me to crush like 2 pounds of malt in a reasonable way.
Right. Well, and, you know, part of it is, you know, storage time because, you know, if you want to buy your grain in bulk.
Yep.
And you want to
yep.
buy, you know, a 55-pound sack. If you buy it pre-milled, there's this, you know, there's very stringent storage requirements of pre-milled malt for it to stay stable versus, you know, malt that's intact. That's stable under your average conditions for a long time, right?
It changes. I mean, once you expose some fats and some things, so, and, you know, pre-ground, you know, I would say, yes, that does have a shorter shelf life. It's easier for it to pick up moisture and have any of the shelf life-related issues. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's, you know, like the stuff's going to go bad right away. You know, it's not like that. It really makes that big of a difference. But, you know, to your point, for sure. Also, you know, it may not necessarily be moving that fast because a lot of times, you know, as a homebrewer, your supply chain has to go through a homebrew store that goes through a distributor that buys from somebody like us. Mm-hmm. So we mill it, and then we send it to them, and then they warehouse it, and then when your homebrew shop orders it, you know, they get it from them, and then eventually when they use up their inventory of pre-ground, then they bring it to you. So, yeah, you know, so if you're going to say it's got 6 to 9 months shelf life, by the time it's in your homebrew store, it, you know, it may be... it may already be 4 months into that, and you know, that's probably not proof with people like Northern Brewing, guys like this that are cranking through the volume, but you know, your average, your smaller place. And so then if you store it for a long period of time, yeah, you know, you very, very well could start to see some quality issues. I agree.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, if you ever, and I think most homebrew shops have a mill that they'll allow you to do for free, at least the ones that I go to, but if you ever find yourself driving there to you know, to mill grain, it's like based on the cost of gas, you'd probably be better off.
And your time. You might as well
get
yourself a mill. For me, the things to look for when buying a mill, I would say durability, one, especially if you're going to brew a lot. And if you're buying a mill, you better be brewing a lot, you know. You want one that's not going to wear out. Adjustable is nice, but not critical. I think what's more important, if you're going to get an adjustable one, get one that adjusts parallel to the two rollers, so it doesn't, you know, wider at one end and narrower at another, I would think.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely not.
And one that you can motorize, you know?
Yeah.
Because you don't want to hand crank this thing.
Yeah.
And those are like the three requirements. Other than that, doesn't really matter to me. I'm sure there's, you know, advantages to other things, but, you know, price-wise, I wouldn't spend a fortune on it. Because I think you can get good results with a fairly basic mill.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, I'll throw out probably a dirty word for homebrew millers. You guys ever use a Corona?
I think
everybody. If you've been brewing for a long time, you probably used one.
When I started, you know, they were still selling Coronas at the homebrew shop, and I knew not to do the Corona mill.
Well, I think, you know, they're like $35 or $40, at least, you know, they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they kind of just cram, you know, shatter everything. But, you know, they do okay. They work a lot better in a rolling pin and a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's like, if you're just buying one for just milling your specialty malts, you know, or occasional things that you can't, I don't think they're that bad.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that I can speak from experience that if you try to mill like a whole 50-pound bag through one because they have no bearings, you'll melt the shafts.
Wow.
Whoops.
That reminds me of another situation. I've read several times on forums where guys will buy their wives a KitchenAid stand mixer because they know it comes with a mill attachment for grinding grain.
That's for making flour.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and you can put in like a cup at a time, so it's not a good option. Two roller mill is the best thing, the best starting point.
Yeah, I would agree.
All right,
I would disagree that you can only do a cup at a time because you know with a couple milk cartons and some duct tape, you know, you can put a whole 50-pound bag on top of a Corona or one of those things if you want.
Yeah. And I can guarantee you Bob has done it. let's take a short break. Can you hang with us through the break, Bob?
Sure.
All right, and we'll come back and we'll take some questions from the listeners. Back after this.
Keep your carboy cap on. This is Brew Strong. We'll be right back.
Do you support the Brewing Network? Do you brew your own? Are you looking for an economical, fun, and legal way to do both? Subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine and do just that. All year long, Brew Your Own will surprise you, entertain you, and educate you with articles on beer and brewing from authors like the Brewing Network's very own Jamel Zalishev and John Palmer. Each issue is a full pint of brewing techniques, homebrew stories, tips and photos, projects to make yourself, and recipes for the avid home brewer. Get your tough questions answered by Mr. Wizard. and polish your style accuracy with DeVille. A portion of every subscription goes to the Brewing Network, so subscribe today at byo.com/brewingnetwork or just click the BYO logo on the Brewing Network homepage and support a fantastic hobby and your favorite broadcaster. Brew your own, the how-to homebrew beer magazine.
Hey, what are you doing, man?
Writing a review of WLP 400.
What? You're reviewing yeast?
Yeah. White Labs has home brewer reviews of all their strains. Are you new to these interwebs? Check it out.
That's awesome.
White Labs, your source for great yeast, invites all brewers to visit whitelabs.com to read and write your own reviews of all their yeast strains. Get real-world tips and tricks from other brewers who have made the most of their vials and post your own experiences. It's another way White Labs brings you closer to the best yeast on the planet.
And send. There you go. You misspelled flocculate, dude.
What?
White Labs. It's all in the vial.
Hi, this is Push from the Brewing Network, and I want to tell you about the Brewmaster's Warehouse and how you can get 10% off your next order. I'm a pretty techie guy, but I've never seen an online store like this. It's awesome. Go to brewmasterswarehouse.com and click on Brew Builder. You can whip up a custom recipe so easily even Sven could do it. Seriously, it's slick. You can share your recipe with your own logo and notes to the Brewmaster's database if you want. And the best part, it keeps a running tally of the beer you're building while you're doing it. Then, bam, click Buy Recipe and your cart is filled and ready to go with helpful suggestions in case you forgot something. This thing is amazing. Brewmaster's Warehouse is run the way a home brewer would do it, with great service, fast turnaround, and $6.99 flat rate shipping. Brewmaster's Warehouse and the Brew Builder blew me away. Check it out today at brewmasterswarehouse.com. I'm serious. And don't forget to put BN Army in the discount code box for 10% off your order. Check out brewmasterswarehouse.com. Cheers.
BN Army members, are you looking for a discount on hops? Keep listening. Nico's Homebrew Supply at nicobrew.com has hops by the ounce and by the pound. Choose from varieties like Amarillo, Centennial, East Kent Goldings, Holler Tower, Simcoe, Summit, Tomahawk, Warrior, Willamette, and more. And adding new varieties all the time, many for less than $20 a pound. Whether a couple ounces at a time or an 11-pound bag, all hops are shipped vacuum sealed and frozen straight to you. Nico's Homebrew Supply offers store-wide $5 flat rate shipping and won't waste your money on unnecessary overhead or advertising. They're going bare bones and passing the savings on to you. The staff at Nico's Homebrew Supply loves to brew and is committed to keeping homebrewing affordable and accessible to anyone who wants to join in this great hobby. And for a limited time, use coupon code BNARMY at checkout for a Brewing Network discount. Visit nicobrew.com. That's N-I-K-O-brew.com for your hops and more. nicobrew.com, your bare bones buddy in the brewing business.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking milling grain. So, Tasty, you ran into an experience where your homebrew shop, they decided they were going to change the gap on their mill to a finer gap, right?
Right, which is their right to do. It's their mill.
Sure.
Right.
And I guess that was because they felt customers were asking for a finer
Something was driving like that, right.
Unfortunately, you've got your process dialed in over many years and many batches.
Right.
And a different, you know, crush all of a sudden changed the beer you were getting. So
yeah, it was the only thing that happened. It's a recipe. Actually, I made two beers, both recipes that I've brewed, you know, many, many times, mm-hmm. and have a great memory of what they taste like when they're done. And both beers came out because of the higher efficiency that I magically got, went from like 74 to 84. They had less body. Little noticeable astringency, I thought,
mm-hmm.
and the attenuation was considerably better. So, you know, I was getting, instead of finishing at like 15 specific gravity. I was finishing like at 9 or something like that. So to me, the beer was losing what I was looking for. These are both like malty beers.
So the attenuation of the beer even changed.
Yeah, it did.
Now, you know, I would imagine, Bob, that, you know, with a finer crush, you know, maybe, you know, in certain mash parameters, times and temperatures, pHs could possibly favor, you know, certain amylases over another, and maybe that's the result in getting a better attenuation in this case?
Maybe. You know, it's hard to say. That you know, what he's saying, I wouldn't normally attribute to just a grind difference. There's, you know, there's got to be something else going on. But the grind affects a bunch of things. I think we talked earlier about with a coarse grind, it takes longer for the enzymes to penetrate. Mm-hmm. And so the conversion could take longer. So potentially if he was using the same, say, conversion based on time, say this many minutes, maybe, you know, the conversion was taking longer. So in the one case with a coarser grind, you know, it wasn't converted as much, and they didn't get as much enzyme activity, you know, penetrating the kernels and acting on the mm-hmm. starch. And in the second case with the finer grind, maybe it happened a bunch faster, and then he had, you know, sufficient beta and alpha amylase to make a more fermentable wort. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be a reasonable explanation of what he experienced.
Because his process is quite consistent, and you know, I've been drinking his beers for many years, and you know, he'll brew that same recipe, and it's pretty much the same unless he decides to change it. So,
is it a combination mash louder, or how does
it's a combination? And I always use rice hulls just to because of the to get a more consistent flow through the bed.
And is it a combination mash louder? Is it heated or?
Yeah, it's bottom. Water? It's bottom fired.
Oh, okay.
So I recirculate during the whole mash. Mm-hmm. And
it's like a rim system. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, but you know, but the only explanation I'd have for that is that maybe it was, you know, again taking the conversion was happening faster, essentially. Because mm-hmm. if you think like at the low temperatures, to get a higher attenuation, especially you. You know, you need the action of those beta amylases over the alpha.
Right.
And if it's converted right away because the kernels are all very small, then the beta probably has more time to act at that lower mm-hmm. temperature, you know what I'm saying?
I see.
Right. Yeah, if you were only holding it at, you know, let's say 148, 149 for 20 minutes, mm-hmm. and then you ramped it up to 156 for, you know, 30 minutes, and then you mashed out, and then you went to a finer crush, and at 20 minutes at the same mash temperature, perhaps you're getting more complete conversion at that that lower temperature.
Exactly. I mean, that's about the only, mm-hmm. assuming everything from the liquid degustation, everything else was, you know, that's about the only explanation I could think. Also, I think I mentioned earlier that when you do increase your extract efficiency, a lot of times the last stuff you're extracting is not as mm-hmm. high of a quality. Mm-hmm. That would maybe explain some of the tannins and the astringency that he was getting.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But you're using the same total pounds of malt, right?
Yeah, exact same recipe I always use.
Okay.
Right.
And so, not really, not sparging any more than he used to.
No.
It's just a finer crush. Now, how different is that perception, what you attribute to astringency? Is it small or large?
To me, it was large. These are beers I made for Thanksgiving. It was my American Brown, which I've made a zillion times, and my American Pale Ale, which is relatively new. But again, I achieve remarkable consistent batch over batch. And I wouldn't even serve them at too many events.
What was the beer style you were making?
American Pale Ale and an American Brown.
Oh, okay.
Both mashed at 154. And
sure.
What we're saying here, it sounds like the grist has no bearing on the number of short or long chain sugars available to my ferment. Is that pretty much what we're saying?
Just the speed at which it does get converted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the net result would be, you know,
I would say that there's an adjustment that you could make. You had a coarser grind, and it was you were getting conversion faster and getting a more fermentable wort. There's something you could adjust for. I wouldn't say that, you know, you need to do a certain crush to get a certain efficiency or a certain amount of fermentability. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of the part I'd argue. So, that's not to say that if you change your crush from a coarse to a fine, you won't see, you know, analytical differences, extraction differences, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's just to say that you should be able to get good extract, good fermentability with any, you know, really almost any crush.
Mm-hmm. You could probably try shortening your total mashing time, you know, say cut it back 15 minutes or so, and maybe you'll see a shift back to the attenuation and flavors that you're used to.
Yeah, and it could be, too, that, you know, maybe there were some differences in the malt. You know, you see even base malt, you know, 6-row malt or 2-row malt, it's alpha and DP. It can range by 30 or 40% from batch to batch. You could get one that's say a 120 or 110 alpha, and then the next time it'll be 150. So, you know, there may have been other factors in there too. But just the crush itself, you know, I'm surprised it had that big of a difference.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you're right. There's things that I think are under control that aren't. I mean, could have been, like you say, a different malt analysis on that particular bag of 2-row, and I made them both beers with the same, you know, base malt.
Could have been the yeast.
Well,
yeah. Could have been the dog didn't
enough dog hair?
Didn't roll in the right stuff.
Yeah, I guess not. Yeah, Bob, I had another question about the malt. You know, I'm always interested in the amount of minerals in my system, in my beer, and at every point. The grain itself brings calcium, magnesium, and a whole variety of things to the mix. Is that something I should concern myself as a home brewer in terms of my total, you know, calcium that I've got into my mash tun and that carries forward to the boil, or is it insignificant? Or
no, I mean, it could be, because I think you're really trying to make something really soft, maybe.
I see.
Then there are some differences between maltsters. When you think about the malt, when we're making it, or anybody else, it's about 40 to 50% moisture in the germination compartment. And so at the end in the kiln, we dry that off. Well, the salt doesn't go anywhere. So the water, you know, there is some contribution to the overall mash from the minerals of the water that were used to make the malt.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there are subtle differences between maltsters in, you know, one may be higher in sodium or other minerals. That said, a normal brew at the end of the day is maybe 10% malt, and maybe of that there was at one time a third of its weight was the water, so it would be like adding, 3 or 10% of a different water. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I wouldn't say it's nothing, but I wouldn't say it's that big of a thing, too. But it would, I say, lead to maybe some of the differences in flavor between, malts produced at different locations or by different maltsters.
Mm-hmm. All right. Great. We need one more short break, and when we come back, we'll get to listener questions. Back after this.
Smart.
Brew strong.
This is Brew Strong.
From the the stovetop to a camp burner to some kind of brew stand. Most homebrewers follow some version of this progression. With each move, a homebrewer will often have to change a lot, if not all, of their equipment. Until now, Blickman Engineering brings you the top-tier brewing stand. The only brewing stand that grows with you. For example, buy a top-tier floor-standing burner now, and it'll bolt right to your top-tier brewing stand when you're ready for all-grain brewing. The top-tier brewing stand is perfect for 5-gallon to 20-gallon batch sizes. Its modular design is adjustable and accommodates everything from small footprint coolers up to 30-gallon pots. How does the top-tier brewing stand do it? At its core is a strong, heat-treated, and anodized aluminum main post. On all four sides are built-in T-slots for the adjustable heavy-gauge stainless steel shelves and beefy burner tiers. The tiers accommodate any manufacturer's pots or coolers up to 21 inches in diameter. Best of all, not only does the top-tier brewing stand grow with your skills and equipment, but it easily knocks down for long-term storage or transport, too. The top-tier brewing stand from Blickman Engineering. Learn more at BlickmanEngineering.com and to find a local Blickman retailer and start brewing from the top tier.
Nico, listen, our lawyers said that we had to do this for 1 hour, and after this, we don't have to talk to each other for 3 more months until the next meeting.
Kids. Come on, let's get out of here.
I'm supposed to have more lines. I'm the professional. Hey, it's Sully.
And I'm Nico.
And we opened the 21st Amendment 10 years ago at 563 2nd Street in San Francisco, just 2 blocks from Giants Park, to make great beer and have a great time doing it.
That's right, because to us, the 21st Amendment is more than just the right to make beer. It's the right to experiment, to be innovative, and just do things differently. And so now, we're putting our craft beer in cans.
That's right, cans. You can find our world-famous Heller High Watermelon Wheat Beer at Brew Free or Die IPA in the Northeast, Northwest, parts of the Midwest, and Alaska in cans and on draft. So next time you're at your local neighborhood pub or good beer store, be sure to ask for 21st Amendment in cans.
Because everyone likes it in a can.
Tasty Crack Cans.
Tasty Crack Can.
Williams Brewing is your online resource for prompt delivery of quality home brewing supplies. Since 1979, Williams Brewing has offered the finest equipment and freshest ingredients and the best customer service in the business. Cut hours off your brewing sessions by using one of our 11 varieties of famous Williams malt extract. Our Williams Belgian Pale Extract is mashed with pure Belgian two-row malt and a small percentage of Belgian wheat malt for an authentic Belgian character you just can't get from other extracts. Or check out our unique fermenters, 2.5-gallon kegs, paintball tank-based draft beer equipment, bottling aids, and much more. We even have our own line of precision hydrometers. Go to WilliamsBrewing.com to browse our vast selection. That's WilliamsBrewing.com. Orders placed by 3:30 p.m. Pacific time ship the same day. Brewing is easy. The Williams way.
There's an app on the iPhone for just about everything, including beer. Apps for finding a pint of beer. Apps that look like you're drinking a pint of beer. And now, there's an app for brewing a pint of beer. Introducing BrewPal, the most all-inclusive beer brewing app for professionals and hobbyists that fits in your pocket and goes wherever you do. Recipe formulation that can be imported and exported with a customizable database. Mash and sparge calculations, yeast pitching rates, carbonation tables, and more. Available right now for less coin than a pound of grain. See BrewPal in action at brewpal.info and download it for your iPhone at a special introductory price right now. BrewPal, all the brewing software you need, right in your pocket.
Hey, Push, the new brewery's looking good.
Thanks, Finn. Piece by piece.
Well, let's fire her up. Whoa! Is that a new kettle?
Yeah, just got it brand new, but paid half price.
What? And that blade scale?
40% off.
The new tap handle?
$5 instead of $13. Got a new regulator for the brew stand, too, but $5 instead of $25.
Dude, where are you stealing all this stuff from?
Where else? The More Beer Deal of the Day.
Announcing the Beer, Beer, and More Beer Deal of the Day. Every day, a new fantastic deal from big items to small that will blow you away. Boil kettles, carboy carriers, sterile siphon starters, digital timers. Watch morebeer.com every day for a new deal, and you just might find the item you've been waiting for at a price you cannot believe. Hurry, because stock is limited on most items.
And that sweet Guinness cap, let me guess,
the more beer deal of the day.
Yeah, I knew it. Come on, let's brew something.
Find the more beer deal of the day at morebeer.com. Celebrity voices impersonated.
This is www.thebrewingnetwork.com.
Sit down next to it, grab yourself a paper towel, and watch those yeast have sex.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to your hosts, Jamil Zainasheff and John Palmer. Putting the testicles in technical. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, we're back. We're also here with a couple of brewing geniuses, Bob Hansen from Brees Malting, and also Mike Tasty McDowell from the Can You Brew It show and the Sunday Session. Yeah, we've covered milling malt extensively, and now's the time for questions from the chat. If you listen live, you can join the chat, ask questions, participate in the show. Good stuff. What do we got, Justin?
All right. Farm Brewer's in the chat room, and he wants to know about crushing wheat versus barley. He says he's heard that you should run wheat through the mill twice. What do you guys think about that difference?
You want to tackle that, Bob?
I'm not quite sure why you would do that. Unless the wheat had a wide assortment. You know, we talked about that earlier where you get kernels of a, you know, very different size.
Mm-hmm.
And you have unground. Typically, with wheat, I go with a coarse grind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just run it through whatever my regular setting is. I know, you know, wheat doesn't have a husk, so you can go ahead and, you know, grind it on down to whatever you want. Wheat tends to be harder than, you know, barley malt. So, you know, if you're grinding it, I don't know, in something that requires you to crank the mill or something, that might be a little more difficult.
Yeah, you might want to set it wide in that case and run it through once just to crack it and the second time to break it. Is he talking about raw wheat or malted wheat? You have any idea?
Yeah, I don't know.
Raw wheat.
I assume malted wheat.
Oh, okay, yeah, because raw wheat, maybe that's a reason to do it because, you know, it's especially like high-protein hard bread or something like that.
Hard as a rock.
Yeah, especially if you're hand cranking it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That could be the reason, yeah.
But other than that, I don't know why, from my experience, why you would need to run it through twice.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't hear it from me.
You certainly can, though. There's no husk to worry about, so it'll actually go through fairly easy the second time.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Alonzo in the chat room wants to know about the flavor differences you get when milling your own grain, you know, say that on brew day, or pre-milled grain. So maybe you order a kit and it has to be shipped to you. It takes a week or two. You guys notice flavor differences from that fresh crush compared to a week or two?
Week or two under, you know, regular conditions, you know, I don't think you'll notice a difference even in side-by-side taste. I would theorize that, you know, the longer the duration, perhaps, yes, you'd, you know, with the malts stored under the same conditions, longer duration, eventually maybe you'd notice some difference.
Yeah.
But, you know, those grains are pretty, you know, oxygen still is going to get into them. I mean,
yeah.
I would agree. It would, you know, for the fresh stuff, being in bulk might have a shorter supply chain to you.
Mm.
Just because I wouldn't be worried about milling my grain a week ahead if I was storing it under good conditions or 2 weeks. But, you know, if the place that sold it to you in your kit, for example, if they didn't mill it themselves, if they bought it pre-ground, and, you know, that was a couple months, and then they bagged it up, and then they put it in kits, and those kits sat around, then, you know, that pre-ground malt, if it came in the kit like that, well, potentially, yeah, there could be, you know, it might actually be 6 months since it's been crushed.
Right.
Not the 2 weeks. But I don't know what, you know, these guys do in terms of their supply chain. They may, when you order the kit, crush it fresh and send it right to you. So.
And if it's in a really humid area or a really humid time of the year, that might have an effect as well. What's the best way to store grain, crushed or uncrushed?
Let's define good conditions. Yeah.
Crushed or uncrushed would be basically in low relative humidity, say below 50%, and typically you'd like to put it in a sealed bag. You know, all food products and everything in general is in equilibrium with moisture. either within its package or outside of its package. And, you know, you don't observe as much with malt and dry grains, these processes. You might see it in a cracker where crackers get stale in your house. You definitely see it, like, if you leave cheese out overnight or bread. They're in their package. They're in nice equilibrium with their environment. But you put them into a house which has below 70% relative humidity for sure, typically, you know, maybe more like 30 or 40, and they dry out. Malt stored in an open container, when we dry it down to 5% moisture, it's at a equilibrium relative humidity of about 20%. So if you store it, you know, in either a permeable bag or in the open, uncrushed or crushed, in anywhere above 20% relative humidity, it'll eventually take up moisture. And when it gets to about 70% moisture, it'll actually be, instead of being, I'm sorry, 70% relative humidity, when it gets to about that level, the malt can actually go from, say, 5% moisture up to about 15, and it'll start to get slack. If it's stored above 80% relative humidity, in general, anytime you get anywhere from your house to your basement to you know, your refrigerator, anytime you're above 80% relative humidity, mold can grow. So you definitely never really want to store anything, you know, in conditions that are higher than 80% relative humidity. If you store malt in a permeable open container in 70% humidity, it'll pick up as much as 10% moisture. And if you're measuring your malt on a pound-by-pound basis, you'll definitely see your extracts go down because now there's 10% more water there, right? Mm-hmm. That's 10% less grain. And eventually, you know, it'll oxidize quicker under those conditions as well. So, you know, ideally you would say 40% or below relative humidity, or, you know, put it in a sealed bag.
Right. And if when your malt goes slack, or when, you know, it takes up this moisture, it tends to oxidize faster and stale, and
yep.
And the fats start to break down. So,
And I've tasted that in competition. I mean, right. You know, when you're tasting beers that are made from old malt, there is a certain mustiness and slight oiliness to the flavor of the beer mm-hmm. that's been made from old malt.
Well, and one of the things to do to check on the storage of your malt is taste some on a regular basis. When you get it fresh, it's nice and
yep.
crunchy and crisp
yep.
feeling in the mouth. And when you when it starts taking up moisture, it becomes softer and, you know, what they call slack. And it tends to be, you know, more mushy and mealy. And then you're getting your grains going bad quickly. So that'll tell you how long you can store something in your environment.
Yeah, I mean, in general, though, if you keep it within a moisture barrier bag or sealed pail, you know, malt will actually store a fairly long time. You know, literally like well over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the caramel malts a little bit longer. Black roasted malts, you know, they're almost infinite, you know.
Right.
Kind of like coffee, you know, you can keep coffee pretty much forever. It may lose some of its aromatic quality, but a lot of that in a black malt isn't surviving anyway or isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it would depend. But in general, it really depends on relative humidity and keep it in the sealed bag or in a dry area. Our bags, depending on the type, all our pre-ground malts go into bags that have moisture barriers. The unground malt, the whole kernel, doesn't. It actually, those bags don't have a moisture barrier, except for some special customers that have very humid environments. And so it's just, you know, it's exposed to the air, you know, because that paper that's there isn't an effective moisture barrier. So normally with any dry grain, you know, cool, dry area.
Well, I got to figure, you know, one of the things against crushed malt is that, you know, it's got a higher surface area, and the higher your surface area, it's got to be a more rapid uptake of moisture and oxygen.
Yep.
So
that gets trumped by the, you know, moisture and oxygen, but yeah.
Right. But again, in a sealed barrier bag, then it's going to be fine.
Yep.
It's, you know, probably better than whole grain stored without the barrier.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's kind of actually my point. Yeah.
Okay. Right? Sedge in the chat room wants to know if you guys could cover a little bit of the do-it-yourself drill mill method.
Well, some of these mills come with a little adapter.
Mm-hmm.
for the drill to hook up to, and you just put your adapter chuck on your drill and in your drill chuck, and then pull the trigger.
In my limited experience, if you have one of these manual drills, it's the way to go. I did a, you know, I had a hand cranked one. You gave it to me, Jamil, and I did a, I ground a 10-gallon batch worth of beer through that with the hand crank, and you know, I'm a weakling, and it tired me out halfway through, man. It was rough. I definitely recommend figuring out how to use that drill bit.
Right.
I do too.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that difficult to hook up a permanently mounted motor either. And that's what I've got. And then you don't have to do anything. You just, you know, you flip a switch and off it goes. You can control the speed precisely. It'll be the same speed every time.
Where do you get a motor like that?
I went down to some motor rebuilding place, electric motor place. And for $35, he sold me a 3/4 horse motor for, you know, that he had rebuilt. And, yeah, cheap. And he threw in some sheaves and... I ended up having to buy a different diameter to get the RPMs I wanted. Okay. I bought a junction box from you know, the Home Depot and wired it up with a switch. And there you go.
All right.
Now, did that motor come with a capacitor? Because that's what people are saying.
The start capacitor?
Yeah.
And, you know, wherever you get your motor, you know, if you're trying to repurpose a motor for something like a dryer or a washing machine or something like that, then sometimes you have to worry about, you know, startup capacitors and things like that. But ones that are wired already to go, you don't have to worry about it.
Okay.
You know, if you get one off a fan or something like that, they tend to be... If you plug it in and it turns, then, you know, all the pieces you need are in there somewhere.
Twins.
Yeah.
Okay. And last question from the chat, although keep in mind we have our Q&A show coming up. You can ask all your brewing questions.
Any kind of questions you got.
Yeah. But Push and Matt and JP are having a party down at Push's house today, and they're listening to the show. They want to know, how would changing a mill setting from three to four be different than running the grain through a mill twice?
Well, I prefer using 11. I have a mill that goes to 11.
Turn this one to 11. Wow.
Yes. And I prefer that because it's one better than the mills that go to 10.
Yeah.
Right.
That is really my preference right there.
Of course.
So that's the answer.
That's the difference. Yeah.
4 is one better, right?
Yes. 4 is one better than 3. They don't understand that. You know, double milling, I think you use the same setting, right? And the point being the husks, you know, once you've got some of the endosperm out, you know, they don't get broken up as much the second time through. But, you know, larger pieces of endosperm will get cracked again and, you know, you get a finer grist in the end. Does that make sense, Bob, or am I talking out my ass like usual?
I don't think you normally do that, but it makes sense. I can't. You know, like, it's hard to say from 3 to 4, you know, that's kind of what you were alluding to there with the number thing, you know. But adjusting your mill versus double milling, you know, I think if you can adjust your mill, you probably should, as opposed to taking a bad adjustment and double milling it. So right. I'm not sure. But if you might, maybe switching from one mill to another, maybe that leads his question, I would say you probably get a better grind with an adjustable mill than you do with a double.
Right.
By double milling it, just because, you know, again, when you're double milling, you're picking one setting. You know, I'm assuming if it says double milling, he's doing the same setting, which you know, you're never going to have one setting that's going to be perfect. You're better to adjust to the grain.
All right. And that's it from the chat room, guys.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Bob, for joining us. I appreciate you hanging out with us for such a long time. You continue to be one of my absolute favorite people in the entire brewing industry.
No, so. You guys too. It's fun to chat. This is great. It really works well. You can see I can actually get things done here in the home brewery while we're on the show. I'll do less of that if you invite me back, I promise.
Yeah, I'll be talking to you about that when we get off the phone here, Bob.
I didn't realize it was so good. You get to have good audio. But,
oh, yeah.
And what was that moaning going on there?
The bad part of it is we can't be in a room drinking beer together talking smart, because I really like it when I get to do that with you guys. So thanks for the invitation. It's good to hear from you anytime.
Are you going to make it out to the homebrew conference in Minneapolis in June?
You know, I have to check. Normally, that's a I'm always there. Mm-hmm. I believe it is like the exact same time as the Master Brewers Conference. I think it's the exact same day, so I'm not sure because I'd probably be presenting at the MBA conference.
Right.
And
but you'd have more fun with us.
I would, and I'd like the beer there better, believe it or not. The AHA, I think, is the best, one of the best place for beer drinking in the U.S. is the AHA National, without a doubt. So, hopefully I'll make it. I'm not sure, though.
Okay. Well, if we see you there, we'd love to share a pint with you.
Great.
All right.
Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Yeah, thanks.
So that's our milling show. Thanks, Tasty, for joining us.
Sure,
and,
glad to be
providing
here.
Your sage advice and interesting comments on the subject. If you get a chance, visit our sponsor, Blickman Engineering, BlickmanEngineering.com. Great stuff. Also, go by BYO. You can subscribe through the homepage of the Brewing Network. Just click on that big BYO logo, and half of that goes to the Brewing Network. Also, we got all sorts of... good merchandise in the store. We got Brewing Classic Styles. We got How to Brew. And pick that stuff up, and all the profits go to the bottom line of the Brewing Network, and that helps keep these shows running as well. And if you're listening live, hang out. We're going to do live Q&A. You can ask any brewing questions you want. Until later, Brew Strong.
Brew Strong.